She does seem to really indicate that she felt her life was really quite full.
Well, and she wanted to, she was observing it, and she thought it was important. She thought not just the only woman part of it, being the only woman in the Philadelphia Orchestra, but because it was growing and becoming such a great orchestra at that time, and she wanted to tell people about it. She wanted to tell women about being the only woman. She said, at the time when she'd tell young girls, their eyes would glaze over. Oh, you know, another first woman. What's the big deal? But she said they didn't know what it was really like. But then she also really thought Leopold Stokowski was a great conductor and that he brought the orchestra together and created such a magnificent institution. She loved that. She loved the her players that she worked with, her fellow members who were extraordinary musicians.
It sounds like the years that she was with the orchestra, starting in 1930, and certain maybe till 46, maybe till 41, but the orchestra was really considered the premier orchestra or one of the premier orchestras in the United States. Is that?
Oh, yes. Rachmaninoff, just in 1929, the year before Edna joined, called it the finest orchestra the world has ever heard. And he was just... he loved it, and then he would love, he eventually came and made recordings with it. And
the seats were totally sold out, at least before the Depression.
Yeah, exactly. They said it was the hottest ticket in town. So there was a joke that Stokowski's second wife married him to get a ticket to the orchestra.
What was she like during the time when you were making your recordings with her?
And think she was very deep and in ways, very profound, but a lot of fun and love to gossip and very lively and very graphic speaker. She was the first woman in a principal position. And she was principal means you're the first chair, you're the solo harp.
But that whole principal thing, I think, was sort of a surprise to her, wasn't it?
It was. She and her teacher at the Curtis Institute, Carlos Salcedo, who had talked her into it, saying, oh, don't worry, Edna, you can do it. You'll be second harpist, and you'll get lots of help from the first harpist, and I'll be here to help you. Well, Stokowski turns around on them and makes her the principal harp. And she was young. She was just getting out of school. She hadn't played the harp. It wasn't her original instrument. So she felt very vulnerable in this great, famous orchestra. It was very much strain for her, yeah.
It sounds like in that first year, or those first couple years, mm-hmm. I mean, the pressure must have just been incredibly intense.
Yeah, she certainly made me feel that when she talked about it.
And your book says in the first year she lost something like 25 pounds.
Right.
I mean,
right.
She was, you know, these things about the first— and then she goes into this hostile world and everything. And I think maybe one of the things that gets lost is how really, really hard she was working to become the harpist that she needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Did she talk about that very much?
Oh, yes. That was the most important thing to her in a way. And it's complicated how she dealt with the men. She had a great plan. And just basically, because she'd learned, because she'd been threatened by being in an earlier orchestra, the Roxy Theater Orchestra, where they chased her all over the place. So she had a plan when she came into the orchestra, and it worked very well, and that was to stay on her own little island, she said, and barely talk to the other men if she didn't have to, because she didn't want anybody to get any ideas. But it didn't even matter. She said, I had to work so hard. All I thought about was the work of it.
She's only studied the harp for 5 years when she becomes this principal harpist.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like just in addition to sort of keeping up with the pace, she enters a pretty hostile environment.
Yes.
What did she say about that?
Well, as I said, she kept herself, her nose to the grindstone. She worked so hard that in a way she didn't care. Right away, her first rehearsal, she looked into these eyes full of sort of disdain for her. And she just kept working. So, she said she just couldn't let herself think about it. She just went on. And she didn't try to interact with them. She didn't, just polite, but nothing, no trying to defend herself or do anything. She just went ahead.
That sort of standoffishness to preserve what she needed to do or her ability to perform and carry on. It didn't last forever, though, with the orchestra, did it?
No, especially with her fellow principal players, Marcel Tabateau, William Kincaid. They were her good friends, and Hillsburg and other first players. And then she gradually became friends with the others. But it really was a while that she stayed alone. And then, you know, in her third year with the orchestra, she married Sam Rosenbaum, who was on the board of directors. So that the other players stood back from her then, too. But she was eventually one of the boys, one of the men. Mm-hmm. And I do say Edna even called the other players of the orchestra the men.
And that audition seems kind of interesting to me. It's an interesting window on what Stokowski maybe was like. Because he didn't even let her finish, right?
Or she said she thought she heard him say, "That's what I like," under his breath. But they didn't know. And, you know, he made no comment. He was very impassive. Apparently, he was that way always. Even in the orchestra rehearsals, he wouldn't say that was good or anything. Like, he'd just move on to the next. He wasn't there for backslapping anybody or comment. He just was. It was all business, in a sense. Music, but it was all business.
That's one of the enlightening things about this book is how the rehearsals really came off, and especially the rehearsals under Stokowski. How did she describe those?
Highly pressured, I think you'd have to say, because he expected you to know the music, follow him immensely. He never said, "Good morning, how are you doing?" You know, he just get right to work. First movement or, you know, scriabin, first whatever he's going to be wanting to play first, he'd just announce it, and then you'd start. And then he'd stop and move on for many measures ahead to work on something else. He figured the coming bars were easy, or they could understand it. The orchestra was all right. He wanted to work on special parts. So he would push them so fast, and they had to absolutely not fumble, look through their music. They couldn't fumble. They had to just hop to it and start playing.
It sounds incredibly intense. And it sounds like there was, in addition to maybe not wasting time, I guess he didn't, it sounds like maybe he had this feeling that if they over-rehearsed, it would take away from the freshness of the performance?
Well, he was concerned about the freshness and often he would change his interpretation sometimes, or he would, just to keep them on their toes. And yes, he wanted the performance fresh. Toscanini also directed the orchestra, and that was an entirely different experience from Stokowski, because Stokowski, it was very intense, but it was quiet. There wasn't talking, there was just paying attention to him and jumping ahead, and you just didn't want to mess up. But with Toscanini, he would scream and yell and break his baton, and everybody, it was just sort of funny. He would just yell at them so much. But he also got great performances from the players. And there was that intensity in that. But it was an entirely different way of doing it. Yeah.
Entirely different, it seems, really. And that was kind of a clash of egos, too, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
Between Stokowski and Toscanini?
Toscanini, yeah. They were rivals. And they were the biggest conductors in the, you know, in the country, in the world at that time. They were very famous. And Arthur Judson, who was the manager of both orchestras, he and himself, the manager of the Philadelphia Orchestra, Arthur Judson, also became the manager of the New York Philharmonic, plus the manager of many of the great musicians of the day. He was really Edna called him a mogul. He was a music mogul, a manager mogul. And he set up a conductor exchange, like a band exchange or something. Anyway, and so Toscanini came to Philadelphia, and he led the Philadelphia Orchestra. And Stokowski went to New York, and he led the New York Philharmonic. And in Philadelphia, the players really suffered because he yelled at them so much. And Edna had many funny stories about it. And then, Stokowski got to New York, the Philadelphians were good. I mean, they did their very best for him. But in New York, there were some problems because, first of all, Stokowski had fired several of their players. And they thought they were big shots, and they were going to show that Philadelphia guy a thing or two. And they kind of were recalcitrant, and Edna said he had to ban some of them. But after that, Edna's good friend, Marcel Tabateau, who was a magnificent oboe player, oboist, he said, and Edna always remembered it, she told me it, and then she wanted me to end the book with it. And that was that by the way, he had played under Toscanini in the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra.
Okay.
So he knew him. So said, well, when I go to a concert with Toscanini, I know it's going to be a perfect concert. And it is a perfect concert. Everything is perfect. Everything is just right. With Stokowski, I go, and they're well prepared. They're interesting. They're beautifully done. Everything's wonderful. And then sometimes the music goes to the stars. And I was saying in there that Stokowski really didn't usually speak to the people in the orchestra, I mean, other than about the music. But every now and then he would poke a little fun at somebody or something. So this time he stopped the plane and he said, "Violas, you remind me of that parable in the Bible about the foolish virgins." And then he stopped and he looked around. He looked around and it said, "But aren't all virgins foolish?" And he looked directly at Edna. And then, on top of that, he drew up and he said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And he was expecting her to giggle or get all red or just do something. And she just maintained her steely quietness with it. And she didn't give in. And he was the one that was left, like, he's got this joke out there, but it wouldn't go anywhere because she just was very calm and looking at him like, "Oh." What? She also used some of that time to tune her harp because he sort of panned out his joke and he took a little time telling it. And so she sort of thought he might justifiably think she might not have heard or something. But whatever she did, she left him with egg on his face. That was good. She did that another time when he did make a real pass at her. And that was 2 years later. And she said she knew something, that it was just heating up. She could feel the interest in her when she would be playing in the orchestra. And one morning, she said, even a baby would have known that something was going on. It was just the steam was coming off him. So he said, at the end of the rehearsal, "Harp, please come here." And she said, "Oh, no, I've got to get up to the podium and talk to him." So she grabbed her music and ran up there so she'd have other people all around her. She didn't want to be alone. And then he took her music and he wrote on it something. He said, "I want you to play an arpeggio here. I want you to do this or that." And so he wrote the music and then he gave it back to her. And other people were still standing around. And she looked at it and said, "Will you take lunch with me? Answer yes or no." Oh, no, what is she going to do? And if she said no, she might get fired. If she said yes, well, her teacher had already warned her not to get mixed up or she'd be thrown away like an old shoe. So she was really in a conundrum. So she said yes. And then she went back to her place and she said, "Well, now at least I have time to figure out what to do." So she came up with a scheme to tell him that she had to teach that afternoon. And so she went up to his office after the rehearsal was over, and she got permission to knock on the door and say, "Oh, maestro, about our lunch, I have to be back at 2:00. And she had already known that he had moved into an apartment out, I guess you would call it Germantown. It was on Lincoln Drive. And so she knew he was out of town, not in town where he normally was. And so he said, "Well, I'm not sure we can get back in time." And she said, "Well, why don't we just go to lunch here in town at Child's or something?" And he said, "Well, what would people think?" She said, "Why should they think anything?" And, well, he said, she just stopped him. And he said, "Some other time."
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.